got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. Last week, we started the show by saying that there are thousands of diets. We went over four of the most well-known ones, so I guess that we have about 997 to go. Just kidding, but we will go over just a few more for those of you who are mad that we left your favorite diet out. Well, let's start raw. Really raw, with the raw food diet, of course.
The raw food diet involves consuming food and drinks that are not processed, are completely plant-based, and ideally are organic.
Raw foodists believe that at least 3/4 of a person's food intake should consist of uncooked food. The Mediterranean diet specifically focuses on the nutritional habits of the people of Crete, Greece, southern Italy, Spain, southern France, and Portugal.
The emphasis is on lots of plant foods, fresh fruits as dessert, beans, nuts, whole grains, seed, and olive oil as the main source of dietary fat, cheese, and yogurt are the main dairy foods.
The diet also includes moderate amounts of fish and poultry, up to about 4 eggs per week, small amounts of red meat, and low to moderate amounts of wine.
Up to 1/3 of the Mediterranean diet consists of fat, with saturated fats not exceeding 8% of calorie intake.
The Mediterranean diet is the most extensively studied diet to date, with reliable research supporting its use for improving a person's quality of life and lowering disease risk. With so many diet types to choose from, how do we know which one will suit us best? One problem that many face is deciding whether to go low-fat or low-carb. So what does research have to say about it?
One of the most difficult decisions when it comes to weight loss diet is picking one that will work well for you.
Keto diets, Mediterranean diets, fasting diets, there are so many options out there for people who simply want to lose weight. However, choosing a diet is tricky. How do we know which one will work best for us, or if the diet will work at all?
Researchers at the Stanford University School of Medicine in California have recently conducted a study exploring one key aspect of this best diet question: whether low-fat or low-carb diets are more effective.
The lead study author, Professor Christopher Gardner, said that we've all heard stories of a friend who went on a diet. It worked great. And then another friend tried the same diet, and it didn't work at all. It is simply because we are all different.
So, in order to gain better understanding of the factors that might drive weight gain and weight loss, Professor Gardner and team also sequenced the participants' genomes. In doing so, they looked for gene patterns that they could associate with the effectiveness of fat or carb metabolism.
Another test measured all the subjects' insulin levels, which have been previously associated with weight gain in some people. For the first 8 weeks of their respective diets, the participants were instructed to consume no more than 20 grams of either fats or carbs per day. That's about the same as 1.5 slices of whole wheat bread for the carbs, or a large handful of nuts in the case of fats.
After that, from the second month of their diet onward, the participants were allowed to make adjustments as needed, adding back 5 to 15 grams of either carb or fat, little by little.
The purpose of these adjustments was to encourage the participants to strike a nutritional balance that they would be comfortable adhering to in the long run, beyond the confines of the study. The idea was to let the subjects in the study follow a low-carb diet plan that they could potentially follow forever, rather than a diet that they drop when the study ended.
As the year drew to a close, those who had been following a low-fat diet had a daily fat intake of 57 grams on average, compared with 87 grams per day before the start of the study. Those on a low-carb diet had a daily carb intake of approximately 132 grams versus 247 grams before the study started.
Participants lost an average of 13 pounds over the one-year period. The scientists were pleased with the impact that the study had on those participants' dietary health, stressing that one of its main objectives was to encourage them to switch to healthful sources of fat and carbs. The caveat of the study was that the participants were told to only purchase from the farmer's market and not to buy processed convenience foods, no matter which diet they continued to adhere to.
They were also told to diet in a way that didn't make them feel hungry or deprived. So what were the final results of the study according to the researchers?
Well, after measuring participants' baseline insulin levels and weight loss progress through the study, the researchers saw that although they had all transitioned to more healthful eating habits, there was still a lot of individual variance when it came to weight loss.
Thus, while some participants lost more than 60 pounds, others gained 15 to 20 pounds. However, the researchers were unable to find any links between gene patterns or insulin output and person's likelihood of thriving on a low-fat versus low-carb diet.
Let's go on to the Zone Diet. The Zone Diet proponents claim that they aim for a nutritional balance of 40% carbohydrates, 30% fats, and 30% protein in each meal. You don't have to add them, they add to 100%.
The focus is also on controlling insulin levels, which may result in more successful weight loss and body weight control than other approaches.
The Zone Diet also encourages the consumption of high-quality carbohydrates. In other words, unrefined carbohydrates and fats, such as olive oil, avocado, and nuts. Can you burn fat even in your sleep without feeling hungry? By balancing the fat, carbs, and proteins you eat, according to the Zone Diet creator Barry Sears, PhD, it can happen in the Zone Diet.
Again, according to Dr. Sears, you will lose around 1.5 pounds in the first week. He also says that the weight that you will lose will be all fat, not muscle or water.
So, will you be hungry on the Zone Diet? You do get 3 meals and 2 snacks a day. Each meal is a mix of low-fat protein, such as skinless chicken, turkey or fish, carbs, which consist mainly of fruits and veggies, and a small amount of good fat, which includes, like we said before, olive oil, almonds, and avocado.
No food is completely banned, but if you are a carb lover, you may find getting used to the Zone plan challenging, if not plain difficult. It encourages you to think of bread, pasta, grains, and other starches as condiments rather than as main or even side dishes.
We all know that veggies and fruits are relatively high in sugar. This means that corn, carrots, bananas, and raisins are on the unfavorable list. Fatty red meat and egg yolks fall into the Zone's bad fats column. Staying in the Zone requires sticking to the rules. You're supposed to eat a meal within an hour of waking, never let more than 5 hours go by without eating, and have a snack before bedtime.
And we are going to reiterate this. On the Zone Diet, you need to stick to the 30% protein, 30% fat, and 40% carbs formula at every meal and snack. You can't pile on the protein at lunch and then have all carbs for dinner.
The diet, pretty much like every other commercial diet, recommends moderate but consistent exercise. Now that pretty much reminds me of the old story called Stone Soup. I really like this story, at least for its moral. It goes something like this.
The Stone Soup Story, read by Susanna Lasky. Some hungry travelers came to a village carrying nothing more than an empty cooking pot. Upon their arrival, none of the villagers were willing to share any of their food stores with the travelers. Then, in the middle of the town square, the travelers filled the pot with water, dropped a large stone in it, and placed it over a fire. One of the villagers became curious and asked what they were doing. The travelers answered that they were making stone soup, which tasted wonderful, and which they would be delighted to share with the villager, although it still needed a little bit of garnish, which they were missing to improve the flavor. The villager, who anticipated enjoying a share of the soup, did not mind parting with a few carrots. So these were added to the soup. Another villager walked by, inquiring about the pot. And the travelers again mentioned their stone soup, which has not yet reached its full potential. The villager handed them a little bit of seasoning. More and more villagers walked by, each adding another ingredient. Finally, the stone was removed from the pot, and a delicious and nourishing pot of soup was enjoyed by travelers and villagers alike. Although the travelers had thus tricked the villagers into sharing their food with them, they successfully transformed it into a tasty and nutritious meal which they shared with the villagers.
Why does this remind me of all that we have said about diets? Well, we seem to see that each diet plan includes exercise as part of the natural, necessary regimen for the plan to work. Or at least alludes to the fact that the diet may not work at all or as well without adding exercise. Just like the stone soup that would not taste good without the additional ingredients brought by the villagers.
So, for example, 30 minutes of aerobic exercise such as a brief daily walk is recommended, along with 5 to 10 minutes a day of strength training. The SOM diet may be quite simple for vegans and vegetarians to accept since 2/3 of your plate is filled with fruits and veggies.
It's also easy to be gluten-free on the SOM diet since the diet strongly discourages eating wheat, barley, and rye products. However, you still need to check food labels carefully to completely avoid gluten. How about having to maintain a low-salt regimen on the SOM diet?
This should be easy too, since the SOM diet has an emphasis on fresh ingredients rather than high-sodium processed foods. So, maintaining a low-salt diet while on the SOM shouldn't be a challenge. So make up your mind on which diet you feel most comfortable with and remember the stone soup adage and include exercise with your diet plan.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just 2 blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Several years ago, Carmen and I developed a mindfulness training course that we often presented at Southside Medical Center to our patients. We still have it available, so we decided upon reading a very recent article in the Pain News recommending mindfulness training for those with chronic pain. And as is often the case, these ancillary pain treatments can be used in addition to prescription medications, often allowing the patient to decrease the amount of pain medications that they're actually taking.
Even though there is no one-size-fits-all treatment for chronic non-cancer pain, there is a range of potentially effective options that people can try.
One of the reasons is that chronic pain is not purely physical. There is an emotional component which includes the ways people perceive and respond to their pain. In 7 trials, patients were randomly assigned to either MBSR, that's mindfulness training, or a control group.
Mindfulness training involved 8 to 12 week sessions with a therapist trained in the program along with 45 minutes of daily home practice.
The patients had long-standing pain from conditions like arthritis, fibromyalgia, and temporomandibular joint disorders, which happens to affect the jaw. A few trials even focused on chronic low back pain. Overall, the team found patients who received either CBT or mindfulness training typically fared better than the control group. They reported more improvements in pain intensity, physical functioning, and even depression symptoms.
The researchers noted that, on average, Those effects were small. These successes are small due in part to the fact that it takes motivation to incorporate what they learn into daily life.
It is important to remember that while medications can often provide immediate relief to the pain, CBT and mindfulness training do not often produce instant relief. It simply takes time to heal and to adopt a new lifestyle. If you're interested in our mindfulness training, give us a call at Southside Medical Center. Our telephone number is 904-641-4411. To end the show, Carmen and I are going to discuss vaccinations, often called immunizations. We did this on one previous study, but I think it is important that we do this just one more time. We do know that vaccines work to save lives from vaccine-preventable disease.
You have likely come across articles or people that state that vaccines are more dangerous than the diseases they protect us against.
Many of these people don't remember the pre-vaccine era when measles, polio, and smallpox, as well as diphtheria, were big killers. But I do.
So even though vaccine side effects are about the same as they always have been, they can become a much bigger focus for some people because they don't see any of the mortality or morbidity from the diseases that the vaccines have gotten so good at preventing.
There are graphs, very good graphs, that demonstrate the incidence of the disease and the maturity of immunization programs. If you look at the graphs, you will see some areas where graph numbers, the graph lines, cross over.
It is at this crossover point that the anti-vaccine folks base their view that more people die from the MMR vaccine than from measles.
The real numbers show that they don't. Although vaccines are not perfectly safe, it is extremely rare for a vaccine reaction to be deadly.
As for vaccines causing death, again, so few deaths can plausibly be attributed to vaccines that it is hard to assess the risk statistically. So, as a parent, you may be concerned, even uneasy, about allowing your children to be vaccinated.
Let's start with why do anti-vaccine folks think that they are more common than they really are? Differentiation between coincidence and casualty is of utmost importance in this respect. Now, this is not always easy, especially when an event is rare and background rates are not available. What we really need is called a risk-to-benefit analysis of vaccinations. They often believe that anything and everything that happens after someone is vaccinated, even if it is weeks or months later, must have been caused by the vaccine.
This discounts the fact that most people have a basic risk, often called the background rate, for developing these conditions that can coincide with getting vaccinated.
Another reason is that they also misuse something called VAERS reports when talking about vaccine deaths. In a review of reports of death following vaccination submitted by the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, that's the VAERS, from the early 1990s, the Institute of Medicine concluded that most were coincidental, not casually associated.
In fact, most of the things that anti-vaccines folks blame on vaccines, including things you see in many of their vaccine injury stories, are most likely not related to vaccines.
Fortunately, most people are vaccinated and deaths from vaccine-preventable diseases are tremendously below what they were in the pre-vaccine era. People do still get vaccine-preventable diseases in the United States. And tragically, people do still die of vaccine-preventable diseases here. For example, in 2015, there were at least 37 cases of perinatal hepatitis B infections. 5 kids less than 5 years died of rotavirus disease. A single 14-month-old died of HIV meningitis. An infant died of pneumococcal meningitis. A 3-year-old with congenital rubella syndrome died. At least 2 teens died of meningococcal meningitis. A woman in Washington died of measles. And 85 children died of the flu.
Of course, worldwide, especially in developing countries, the number of deaths are much higher, which is a good reminder of what would happen if more of us stopped vaccinating.
And it is even better a reminder that you have to look at the number of deaths from vaccine-preventable diseases today in the context that most people are vaccinated and protected. If you're truly looking at risk versus benefit analysis of whether or not to get vaccinated, it's still the great benefit of avoiding vaccine-preventable diseases versus the very small risk of getting vaccinated that you should think about.
It is also the small risk of getting vaccinated against a much greater risk of going back to the pre-vaccine era if you decided to skip or delay any vaccines.
Remember that millions of vaccinations are given to child and adults in the United States each year, and serious adverse reactions are rare.
However, because of the high volume of use, coincidental adverse events, including death, that are temporarily associated with vaccination do occur.
It's not that the risk of getting a vaccine-preventable disease is low because you are counting on everyone else in the world to get vaccinated and eliminate or eradicate the disease and your risk. If too many parents who are on the fence start believing that their kids have no risk or zero risk of getting polio and other vaccine-preventable diseases and continue to skip or delay vaccines, then boom, we are back in the days when outbreaks would close schools and kids would suffer from the devastating effects of these diseases. I've seen it. One more thing that we have to say before we end the show. Autism and its relation to immunizations is important to discuss. First, let me say that the CDC states that there is no link between vaccines and autism. Some people have had concerns that autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, which is a developmental disability that is caused by differences in how the brain functions, might be linked to the vaccines children receive, but studies have shown that there simply is no link between receiving vaccines and developing ASD.
One vaccine ingredient that has been studied specifically is dimerosal, a mercury-based preservative used to prevent contamination of multi-dose vials of vaccines. Research shows that dimerosal does not cause autism.
In fact, a 2004 study concluded that the evidence favors rejection of a causal relationship between thimerosal-containing vaccines and autism. Autism rates in developing countries have risen remarkably in the past 20 years. For children born in 1992, about 1 in 150 would be diagnosed with an autism spectral disorder, again, ASD. Children born in 2004, about 1 in 68 children would receive an ASD diagnosis. Beginning in the 1990s, our understanding of the spectrum of autism has expanded greatly, and now individuals who would most likely previously not have been thought of as having autism may be classified with one of a variety of ASDs.
So maybe the higher rates of autism today are due to increased diagnosis and reporting, changing definitions of autism, or an actual increase in development of ASD.
In 1998, Wakefield, along with 12 co-authors, published a case series study in The Lancet, claiming that they found evidence in many of the 12 cases they studied of measles virus in the digestive systems of children who had exhibited autism symptoms after MMR vaccination.
So, Wakefield postulated a relationship between MMR vaccination and autism. Wakefield suggested in a video released to coincide with the paper's publication that a causal relationship existed between the MMR and autism.
He then recommended that the combination MMR vaccine be suspended in favor of single antigen vaccinations given separately over time. It is important to know that Wakefield himself had filed for a patent for a single antigen measles vaccine in 1997, and so would seem to have a potential financial interest in promoting this view.
Over the next 12 years, the possibility of a link between MMR and autism was studied exhaustively.
Not one reputable, relevant study confirmed Wakefield's findings. Instead, many well-designed studies have found no link between MMR and bowel disease or MMR and autism. Again, in fact, in 2004, then-editor Dr. Richard Horton of The Lancet wrote that Wakefield should have revealed to the journal that he had been paid by attorneys seeking to file lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers.
And Dr. Horton claimed that Wakefield's research was fatally flawed.
Most of the co-authors of the study retracted the interpretation in the paper, and the magazine Lancet, where the article was initially published, formally retracted the paper itself. As a parent, you must make your own decisions. Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.